Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Sydney Bowles is a producer and reporter at the Apple Shop radio station WMMT in Whitesburg. She's also a reporter for the Ohio Valley Resource and a contributor to NPR. And Sydney has been looking into how eastern Kentucky coal miners have been responding to and dealing with COVID-19. She joins us from Apple Shop in Whitesburg. So I know that your reporting has left you feeling a need to get the word out to coal miners about the precautions that they need to be taking during this pandemic. And so for starters, what are you hearing? How is the pandemic being viewed in the Kentucky coalfields region?
You know, just like anywhere, there's a wide variety of responses to this thing, right? Some people might not be taking it as seriously. Maybe they think it won't be a big deal because we're so isolated. But a lot of people are definitely staying home, wearing masks, limiting their contact with other people. But it's also true that even though we do have a low number of cases in eastern Kentucky, the economic impact is really real. So I can't quantify this, but I feel pretty confident in saying that there are very few people who haven't felt this pandemic in a very real way.
What have you learned in your reporting that left you with this sense of urgency about getting information about precautions to coal miners?
In a lot of ways, the coal industry is just like a lot of these other high-risk industries that we've been hearing about, like the meatpacking industry, jails and prisons, nursing homes. These are all jobs that you can't do from home or you have to work right up next to other people. And it's harder to implement some of those safety precautions that we've all been asked to start doing. But coal mining is also really different because working underground, working even on strip jobs, on surface mines, exposes you to coal and rock dust that makes your lungs vulnerable. And the coronavirus is a respiratory disease. It hits the lungs. So coal miners who are working may not be able to implement safety precautions. They may also be at a disadvantage because of their lung function, even if they don't have a diagnosis. So if this epidemic really starts hitting our coal mines, it could be catastrophic.
You spoke about all that to Dr. Brandon Crum, a radiologist in Pikeville. Let's listen to a clip.
I think the first thing to know and the first thing I'd like to tell the miners out there is COVID-19, it's real. It's a very serious virus, and it's potentially fatal, especially to anybody with chronic lung disease. And chronic lung disease fits the mold with black lung disease.
Dr. Crum has some important background in calling the nation's attention to the full extent of black lung disease in eastern Kentucky. Did he talk to you about what the virus can mean, especially to minors and particularly those with black lung?
Yeah, he did. There are a couple of reasons that miners are especially at risk, and it's a little bit different for miners that are currently working, people who are underground on a day-to-day basis, versus retired miners who may have a different set of issues. So let's start with the working miners. Every day, coal miners get ready for their shifts in changing rooms where they're in close proximity to one another. They enter the mines on what are called man trips, these tightly packed elevator rides underground. And once they're down there, they may not have a lot of control over how close they're standing to one another. And plus the airflow underground that's required to keep the coal dust low, that air is circulating, and it makes it more likely that if one miner gets sick, more will. We also know that a lot of miners' wives work in the healthcare industry, so it wouldn't be out of the question for a nurse to contract the virus at her job, spread it to her husband, and then he could get a lot of folks on his work shift sick as well. And then if we want to talk about retired miners, even if you have a very mild case of black lung, you are at higher risk of dying if you come into contact with this virus. Black lung is a lung disease. It damages the tissues of your lungs. So you will have a harder time fighting this coronavirus than someone who doesn't have that kind of disease.
So, Sydney, we're all hearing that testing, tracking, and social isolation seem to be the keys to tamping down the spread of COVID-19. Let's listen to what Dr. Crum told you about tracking among coal miners, and then I'm going to have a follow-up question for you.
It's going to be really hard to find out actually how many people with the disease in the ICU or how many people have passed away have the underlying condition of black lung. I think that's going to be one of our biggest hurdles is to be able to track that.
So tell us, Sydney, about those hurdles. What factors stand in the way of effectively tracking COVID-19 among minors?
Well, for retired minors who have black lung, we might just not know because most of the names of coronavirus patients are kept out of public reporting. And that's a good thing. We want to protect people's personal medical information. But it also means that we may not know if a lot of coal miners with black lung disease are getting sick. It may just not show up in the numbers. For working miners, there's no good reason why we aren't having this information tracked. The reason that we don't know is because no one's tracking it. To my knowledge, there's nothing standing in the way of this happening. It's just not happening. We've seen similar things in other industries. We saw that there was a public outcry for states to start tracking nursing home deaths and cases popping up in meatpacking plants. We see that we don't get to see these numbers until we start seeing a lot of cases. I sent questions to several government agencies about this, whether this kind of tracking is happening and why it is or isn't. And I have to say the responses I got seemed like a fair amount of hot potato. Everyone's just saying, we take the health of our minors very seriously, but it's not our job to track this. If it's all right with you, I want to read you the response I got from the West Virginia Office of Mine Safety, Health, and Training, because it's really typical of what I've been hearing from this kind of agency.
Sure.
Can I read you this response?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. So I asked what they were doing to protect miners underground, as well as how they were tracking if and whether miners were getting the coronavirus. And the response that I got was, the agency can only enforce the code under which it operates. There remains nothing in code that would extend the agency's jurisdiction to public health. As a result, it has no authority to provide guidelines or mandate procedures related to pandemic response. So essentially, the agency that's responsible for miners' health and safety in West Virginia is saying a respirable virus is a public health issue, not an occupational health issue. So it's not their job. When I spoke to the public health agency in West Virginia, they said to ask the local health departments. I haven't been able to get in touch with those local health officials. But regardless, the conclusion here is that there's no central agency keeping track of what this epidemic looks like for our nation's coal miners.
Well, Sydney, we know we're talking about individuals here who are very proud of their work. They are generational in that work and very reluctant to turn to other people to help with simple things in life. Again, let's listen to Dr. Brandon Crum on that.
But let people help you, you know, let people go to the grocery store for you, let people go to the post office for you, let people go to the hardware store. Just let people help you during this time so you can stay away from people, you can stay out of the general population, and you can stay safe until this thing is better under control.
So, Sydney, what's your observation? Are minors and their families getting the message about COVID-19?
I guess I want to disagree with you a bit on your assertion that coal miners might be reluctant to turn to friends and neighbors for help. In some cases, that may be true. But it's also true that coal mining communities have also had really powerful kin networks, church communities, other kinds of support systems. And I want to recognize the work that those support networks are doing right now, whether it's food distribution, making face masks or hand sanitizers, checking in on one another's mental health. It's one of the things that makes me really proud to live in East Kentucky. But it can also be hard to ask for help, whether you're a coal miner or not. So if there are coal miners listening to this, or if you're listening to this and you have a coal miner in your life, it's really important for coal miners to limit their exposure to other people right now, wear a mask if you can get one, and let the people you love take care of you. The last thing I'll say is that Dr. Crum, who we've been hearing from, he would want me to get this out as well. He's distributing face masks out of his clinic in Coal Run, Kentucky, near Pikeville. And there's another distribution site at Appalachian Citizens Law Center in Whitesburg in Letcher County. So if you don't have a mask, now's the time to get one. And there are people who want to get you a mask so we can all work together and keep each other safe.
Sydney Bowles, producer and reporter at the Apple Shop radio station WMMT in Whitesburg, and you'll also hear her reports for the Ohio Valley Resource and NPR on WEKU. Thanks, Sydney.
Thank you.
Maxi Flats. Heard of it? It's a long story. So long that we're going to present it in two parts, beginning with next week's edition. University of Memphis historian Carolyn Payton has conducted extensive research and written an article about maxi flats for the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society.
As the nuclear industry expanded beyond, you know, simply defense purposes, the problem of where and how to dispose of radioactive waste, both high level, such as spent fuel from nuclear reactors, to low-level waste like animal carcasses and medical scrubs exposed to radioactivity, all of that had grown considerably. And initially, from the 1940s to the 1960s, some of this radioactive waste was disposed on land, but some of it was also disposed at sea. And in fact, you even had plans to dispose of more radioactive waste along the Gulf Coast and in the Atlantic Ocean. And this prompted a lot of public opposition. And so suddenly federal officials had to find other places to bury this waste.
So the search was on for places to dispose of wastes that would include highly radioactive plutonium, uranium-233, and enriched uranium-235, all buried in unlined trenches.
One of those sites ended up being in Kentucky, in Fleming County, the Maxi Flats disposal site.
Maxi Flats is no longer in operation, but it's still there on the southern border of Fleming County, about 9 miles northwest of Moorhead.
The real turning point came when the Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, got involved and had determined that not only did you have some radioactive isotopes or radionuclides leaving those trenches, but in fact, you had radioactive isotopes of plutonium that had migrated far beyond the site, and this caused considerable concern about the safety of the site.
Had it reached groundwater at that point?
By the mid-1970s, from monitoring the site, they had determined that radionuclide migration had absolutely reached groundwater.
The story of the Maxi Flats disposal site in two parts, beginning with next week's edition of Eastern Standard. WEKU is now providing a daily 10-minute coronavirus update wherever you listen to podcasts and at WEKU.org. Just look for the blue coronavirus link and click the Listen Now tab to hear the latest stories. Coming up in a moment, our series on the centennial of ratification of the 19th Amendment establishing the right of women to vote. We'll hear about the courage of Kentucky women who stood up and demanded not only the right to vote, but also for the abolition of slavery. And some advice for the homebound.
Try not to cut your own hair because it can end in a tragedy.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at WEKU.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Did you know that just over 100 years ago, in 1919, a woman was the de facto president of the United States? President Woodrow Wilson had suffered a blood clot that caused paralysis, partial blindness, and brain damage, and for the remainder of his term, he was totally incapable of meeting with lawmakers, governing, or performing the duties of the presidency. The First Lady, Edith Wilson, stepped in and assumed his role, controlling access to the president and making policy decisions on his behalf. It was in August of 1920 when the Tennessee House of Representatives voted 50-49 in favor of ratifying the 19th Amendment, establishing the right of women to vote. We continue our monthly series in this centennial year of ratification of the 19th with co-host, University of Kentucky history professor, Kathy Kern.
My guest today is Dr. Vanessa Holden, who's Assistant Professor of History and African American and Africana Studies at the University of Kentucky. So welcome, Dr. Holden.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Your research is on gender and slavery in the antebellum South, and I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand how enslaved or newly emancipated women expressed themselves politically or thought about the right to vote.
Sure. I think that it's a common misconception that during the period of American slavery, that African Americans were barred from having a political life. In reality, African Americans, both free and enslaved, expressed their politics and political opinions both through their actions and through a very active political activist culture, particularly in free Black communities in the North. African American women were an integral part of these communities, so it wasn't just that free Black men had politics. Everybody had a politics.
So free Black communities in the North, I'm thinking probably one of the most important suffragists of American history is Sojourner Truth, even though she might be seen primarily as an abolitionist, but she was so important to the history of the women's rights movement.
Oh, yes. And a lot of people don't know that Sojourner Truth lived in upstate New York. Her first language was Dutch. And her work as an abolitionist overlaps significantly with her politics around citizenship and the rights of women, that she's a significant advocate for women's rights, even as she's advocating for abolition.
So how important in the history of the 19th Amendment is the role of the 15th Amendment, in which the federal government prohibited states from denying the right to vote based on a citizen's race, color, or previous condition of servitude?
The 15th Amendment is passed during radical Reconstruction, a period of time when the federal government is radically redefining itself as able to do things like decide on voting rights, decide who gets to vote, decide who is a citizen, to make a decision about whether slavery is or isn't legal everywhere. And that radical moment comes out of decades of radical activism. And it's very hard, especially in the earlier period of the women's rights movement, to separate out who is an advocate for abolition and what is the abolitionist movement, and who is an advocate for women's rights. But many of the women who go to Seneca Falls in 1848 come out of the abolitionist movement. And the vanguard of that movement are African Americans who are advocating for abolition from the moment of the founding of the nation and from well before. So many white abolitionists are actually learning activists and activist tactics from African Americans. And the same goes for women, that white women are learning from the activisms of Black women. And they're actually coming up in a movement in which Black women are incredibly active. There were a lot of high hopes post-Civil War that maybe because of the ways that women served their country so valiantly, that they contributed to things like sanitation efforts, like the Freedmen's Bureau, that this would demonstrate that they should, in fact, get the right to vote. And there's a huge letdown for a number of women's rights activists when the amendment makes clear that it's for men.
Right. I was thinking, as you were saying that the Civil War was so many American deaths, people really thought this was an opportunity to reforge the nation and to make it live up to the ideals of the founding documents, right? And that all inequalities, if we were going to fix some inequalities, let's just go ahead and fix them all in the period of Reconstruction.
Oh, yeah. And there is a huge letdown. And there are serious racial fissures where certain women's rights, white women's rights activists are furious that Black men who were recently enslaved and have little or no education will be allowed to vote. by virtue of their biological sex. And they, fairly well-educated middle-class women who fought for abolition, are still going to be barred from doing so. And there's some pretty deep hurt between Black and white women's rights activists because of the role that race plays in how that amendment comes to be. Interestingly, though, the broader story of women's suffrage is pretty haphazard state by state. In Kentucky, for example, women who were heads of households and taxpayers as early as 1838 had the right to vote on tax and education issues in parts of rural Kentucky. So a full decade before Seneca Falls, certain women in Kentucky have a right to vote. In 1894, women win school suffrage in Lexington, Covington, and Newport. So the ability to vote on issues pertaining to schools. And then in 1906, the state legislature takes that right away because they're worried that African-American women who are included in that earlier law will elect too many Republican school officials. So they'll take away control from Democrats. When women win that right back in Kentucky in 1912, they win it back, but with a literacy test. One of the hallmarks of Jim Crow policies, literacy tests for voting rights. They win it back with a literacy test to hopefully bar Black women from taking advantage of very limited voting rights. So the broader story, state by state, there are all these moments where women do have suffrage and Black women are quick to do their best to take advantage of those moments and hopefully make their voices heard.
But you raise such an important point, Dr. Holden, that it is not just a march of democracy where more and more people get included in the electorate and get included in having the rights of citizens. We also have moments where people lose the right to vote, as the example that you just gave, where Black women lose the right with those literacy tests. And it's also a question about the relationship between federal power and state power, right? So some states are further ahead, and it's a complicated history. It's not simply, women were voting up till 1920, then they all get to vote, right?
Yeah, I think that it's also important to remember that before about the 1830s, the early 1830s, most states had restrictions on voting rights that pertain to men. I think, at least when I work with students, a lot of them have the idea that all white men could vote. And in reality, most of the early states in the nation had property requirements and wealth requirements for voting. And with the expansion of the franchise to all white men, universal white male suffrage by roughly the 1830s, many states that adopt a policy that opens up voting to more men explicitly constrict voting for other groups of people. So, for example, in New Jersey, fairly early on in the nation's history, women with the right amount of property have the right to vote. That's taken away from them in the early 19th century. In some areas, free Black men have the right to vote, but when the franchise expands in the middle of the antebellum period, laws are written that explicitly bar them from taking advantage. So it's exactly like you said, it's not a linear story of progress, that often in American history, when democracy expands for one group, it means the explicit restriction of democracy for other groups.
As you were saying, many people don't understand the extent to which the suffrage was really seen as a privilege of the wealthy elite in the early part of our nation's history. And that story of how the electorate opens up to white men who have no property state by state is still not part of our national narrative, not the way we think about ourselves as a country.
Exactly. I often do an exercise with students where I have them self-identify and keep their hand raised as long as they can. And typically, by the time we get to the property requirement, everybody's hand is down. And in a lecture hall of 200 people, having that visual of looking around and realizing that none of them would have the right to vote in the era of the early republic, really drives home that the Jacksonian era in the 1830s is the end of a really hard-fought march for an expansion of suffrage, or even tying suffrage to citizenship, that it's seen as such an important piece of being a citizen is a political social idea that develops and has fought for over time. And I think that's why it's so important to think about the ways that African Americans are influencing American political life before emancipation, that people who live in a society where it isn't true that all white men automatically have the right to vote are actually fairly adept at using other means of making their political voices heard. So Mumbette, a woman who changes her name to Elizabeth Freeman, her court case is a way that ensures that all African Americans in the state of Massachusetts are guaranteed freedom by Massachusetts's state constitution right after the revolution. She doesn't have the right to vote, but she's able to use other means with the support of white allies to drastically affect the political position of African Americans in the state of Massachusetts. The same goes for the Free Black community in Philadelphia, that they managed to found Black institutions that support Black life and work very closely with white abolitionists to affect change in the nation. And even in slave states like Kentucky, African Americans are making their voice heard, not through formal political protests, but often with their feet. Kentucky is home to some of America's most famous enslaved people because it's home to some of America's most famous fugitive enslaved people. That African Americans are constantly advocating for their freedom, even if it's not through formal political channels.
Well, that's a really good point, that political power is not just expressed through the individual right to the vote, but that people were creative and expressing power and agency in other ways, which leads me to my next question, which is, sometimes the right to vote is considered an individual right, but often we hear people in the Black community, and particularly those Black women who you were pointing to earlier, who are really caught in the middle with the 15th Amendment. Do they support it because it's important to the men in their lives and their families to have that right to vote, or do they withhold their support because it didn't enfranchise women in America? So talk to us a little bit about the way in which African-American communities thought about the right to vote as something larger than an individual right.
So in the era of emancipation, which includes roughly just before the American Civil War through Reconstruction, African-Americans have a number of issues of political significance that they care about. And Black women are at the forefront of each of these issues, the most important of which is emancipation itself. But emancipation is, of course, a process. Yes, there's a moment of legal emancipation where someone is no longer enslaved but considered free, but defining what emancipation means is a much longer process, one that African Americans participated in very, very actively. Black women advocate alongside Black men for access to schools, for the building of religious institutions and the right to worship freely, something they had been denied under slavery. Access to marriage rights and the protections that legal marriage offers Black families and Black couples. They advocate for literacy. And all of these are done in the context of community. So when it comes to the vote, yes, of course, Black women want the vote, but they also are willing to advocate for kind of stepping stones to the expansion of the franchise. Many Black women are involved in union leagues, these organizations that register Black voters in high numbers in the American South. They go with men to the polling places, sometimes to actually protect them from violence at the polling places. They keep the institutions like Black churches and Black schools where political meetings can happen. They keep them up and running. They make sure that they're well maintained so they can actually house these kind of political activities. So while it's certainly true that Black women who certainly want the right to vote for themselves continue to be incredibly active in the women's suffrage movement, they're also able to, in the era of emancipation, participate in the expansion of the franchise in these community-based ways, that they see votes for Black men as votes that are going to help and protect the Black community.
My guest today has been Dr. Vanessa Holden, a historian at the University of Kentucky. Thanks so much for taking your time and for sharing this work with us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
To live here, you have to fight. How Women Led Appalachian Movements for Social Justice, a book by Jessica Wilkerson, Assistant Professor of History and Southern Studies and Graduate Director of Southern Studies at the University of Mississippi. And she is on the Editorial Advisory Board of the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Your book is described by a reviewer that I read as, quote, essential reading for anyone seeking to understand the war on poverty in Appalachia, end quote. And it amplifies the roles, which are often vital in history, that women have played in Appalachia. Am I correct that you focused on events that took place in the 60s and 70s?
That's right. Yeah. And my project really started with a question about how women in Appalachia, and in particular Eastern Kentucky, were involved in the war on poverty. And there had been quite a few books written about the war on poverty, especially the Appalachian War on Poverty, but relatively little about the women who were so essential to anti-poverty programs. And so I wanted to show how they were involved in the war on poverty, but also how they used the momentum of that federal program to kind of spark other social movements that ended up animating 1960s and 70s Appalachia.
For many who have explored its culture, its people, and economics, Appalachian Kentucky turns out to be a much more complex, much more complicated place than anticipated. Was that the experience that you had?
Certainly. And I think that's always something that historians are interested in. I mean, as a discipline, we often are charting what we call change over time, as well as continuity. So what stays the same? What's different? We understand that places and people aren't static. And so I wanted to show how people, and in particular working class women, were responding to federal policies and how they were also responding to changes in the economy over the course of their lives. They lived, for the most part, in coal camps. And so how did the economy and how did politics shape their lives? And in turn, how did they shape those things as well?
I understand that you did quite a lot of oral history research for this book. What was it like for you to hear those voices?
Yeah, so oral history was really fundamental to the project, and it's really how the project began. So in fact, I'm from East Tennessee, and when I got started initially, I wanted to focus on my home, and I wanted to write a book about women in East Tennessee. And the more I talked to people there, the more I heard about all of these women in Eastern Kentucky who had been really models for people elsewhere. And people kept saying, well, I really think you should go talk to folks like Eula Hall or Edith Easterling or Sue Ella Kobach. And so I ended up contacting many of those people and conducted oral history interviews. And it really shaped the story that I was able to tell. And part of that has to do with the fact that in most archival collections, especially when we're talking about governmental archival collections, we don't hear or see much from working class women. And so in order to tell the story, I really had to talk to those women and then go read in the archives and kind of read against the grain and try to piece together the story. And so talking to them was really fundamental for the book. And also I'll say that there's, as you probably know, there's a long tradition of documentary work in Appalachia. And so with places like Apple Shop and other photographers and documentary filmmakers who were filming people and interviewing people in Appalachia in the 60s and 70s. So I also used many of those sources in order to tell the story.
You know, I wonder, Jesse, if historians a half century from now will look back on this time as a time of change for that perception of the role of women in Appalachia. Do you think, have things changed?
Do you mean have things changed in their roles or in the perception of their roles?
In the perception of their roles, in the recognition of their roles.
Oh, definitely. And I think right now, you know, you and I are talking amid a pandemic where many of us are sheltering at home. But as we know, there are also many essential and frontline workers, and the majority of those people are women. And that's also the case in Appalachia, where you have many women who work in healthcare, or they work in home health aid services, and in grocery stores, and in daycares. And so I think more than ever, not just in Appalachia, but across the entire country, we're seeing that women perform really vital roles, and they historically have done so, but oftentimes that labor is undervalued. And I think that I hope, and I do think there will be a shift in how we think about women, what has typically been women's labor.
Bravery and persistence come through as central to the character and the nature of these women as you describe them. And why do you single out these particular virtues?
Well, I think that when I was interviewing these women and when I was doing the research on their lives, I was really struck by how many of them had relatively little in the way of education and wealth and resources, yet they were willing to speak up against some of the most powerful people in their communities and in the state and, in fact, in the country. And they really demanded that that our society be more democratic and that it be more fair. And that takes a lot of courage for anyone. But I think it's particularly difficult if you don't have a lot of power at your disposal in the first place. You know, I'm a university professor. It's a little bit easier for me to speak out, and it's often expected that I'm going to be a kind of critic in my society. But these women didn't necessarily have that platform, but they built it for themselves and they spoke up and they risked oftentimes their own jobs. One woman I wrote about, Edith Easterling, she lost her job as a school cook when she got involved in the war on poverty. Other women risked their husbands losing jobs when they spoke up. Many of them were accused of being, you know, leftist and communist as a way to undermine the work that they were doing. And so they really risked a lot. And I wanted to capture the stakes of that fight for them.
Well, tell us about some of the unlikely coalitions that these women found themselves joining in service to a common cause.
Yes. So for the most part, I wrote about white working class women. And the reason for that is that the anti-poverty programs in Appalachia really targeted white working class communities. Now, there were also African-American working class communities. And unfortunately, because of the way that the policies were designed at the time, many of those resources didn't reach Black folks who often were, had more need than white working class communities and were dealing with more poverty. So the book really focuses on the people who ended up getting those resources. Now, at the same time, they ended up building coalitions with many African Americans and civil rights activists and welfare rights activists. And many of those people were African Americans who were leading those movements. So I'll give you just two examples. So one of the alliances formed around the Poor People's Campaign, which was Martin Luther King Jr.'s final campaign. Of course, he didn't live to see it, but in 1968, he had called for a coalition of poor people of all races and ethnicities. And what happened is there was a campaign in DC there were these camps set up and people from all over the country showed up in DC and they would protest together and really demand an expansion of the war on poverty. They were also protesting the Vietnam War, which is taking resources away from things that might help people in terms of, let's say, the social safety net. And so that's one example of the coalitions that the women I write about were part of. The other one grows out of the Poor People's Campaign, and that is the welfare rights movement. The welfare rights movement was begun by Black women who were receiving aid to families with dependent children, or what we popularly call welfare. And those women really argued that their labor of raising children was important and valuable, and that they needed the resources to be able to do that well. And many white women and men, I think that's sometimes the surprising part, is that men were also involved. They joined forces with Black welfare rights activists, and they protested together in Frankfort, Kentucky. They also went to DC together, and they really demanded an expansion of the social safety net. They said that every citizen in the United States deserves the right to have shelter and to be able to eat and to be able to maintain your basic quality of life.
Upon reading this book, what would you hope that men would take away from it?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. Well, I think to the point that I just made about welfare, I think what surprised me in writing the book is that working class women and men joined together in the welfare rights movement. And today, welfare is really stigmatized, and it's really, people see it as a sign that people are lazy or they don't want to work, and that they don't deserve it. But in the late 60s, that stereotype, at least among working class people, didn't really exist yet. What people, including many men, argued was that at some point in our lives, we all need help. We're all going to be dependent at some point. And for many of the men who got involved, it was because they had contracted Black lung disease. And so they had worked hard, and then they were still struggling. So what does that mean if you live in a society that just kind of abandons you when you can't do hard labor anymore? And so I think for me, I guess I would say, opening up that story that we often assume is only about women and allowing us to see that men and women were working together on many of these issues is really important. I consider myself a women's historian, and I start from the perspective of women. But what I would say is that when you're talking about working class communities, women and men by necessity are often working together to survive. And I think that's important to remember.
I grew up in Eastern Kentucky, and I have to say that studying your book has really made me think about the women that were really important in the community that I grew up in. A doctor, for example, Claire Louise Caudle, who was just amazing, and now the regional hospital in Moorhead, Kentucky is named for her. And I have to believe that there are many, many, many more examples of that kind of strength throughout the region.
Yes, absolutely. And I do want to say that I feel like my book just took a tiny slice of that story of telling women's stories and how they helped to shape their communities and the vital work that they did there. And so I want to say to your listeners, especially those who might be interested in being historians eventually, that there's a lot of research yet to be done on the women who had a big impact on the history of Appalachia and in Kentucky history. So there are many, many more books that could be written.
Jessica Wilkerson, author of To Live Here, You Have to Fight, How Women Led Appalachian Movements for Social Justice, published by the University of Illinois Press. It's available as a paperback or digital on Amazon.com. Now at the University of Mississippi, as I mentioned, Dr. Wilkerson will, in the fall, join the West Virginia University History Department as the Robbins Chair in Appalachian and 20th Century U.S. History. Thanks and good luck, Jesse. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom.
On the Today Show recently, Walmart CEO Doug McMillon was asked about the pulse of America and what items customers are purchasing that surprise him.
Before I let you go, as the CEO of Walmart, you certainly have a unique view on the pulse of America. Is there anything that people are buying a lot of right now that kind of surprised you?
You know, you can definitely see that as people have stayed home, their focus has shifted. You know, it started out with food and consumables, and then it moved to things like puzzles and games, things to entertain kids and educate children, as you would guess. Lately, we've seen more grooming products. People are starting to need a haircut, and so you start to see more beard trimmers and hair color and things like that. It's interesting to watch the dynamic play out.
WEKU's Wendy Barnett put in a call to somebody who could offer some tips for quarantine hair care.
Joining me by phone is Earl Burns, Master Stylist. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Earl.
Hello.
We've seen the videos and photos of people cutting their own hair during the stay-at-home order. Earl, what advice do you have for home hair care during this time?
Try not to cut your own hair because it can end in a tragedy. But if you do follow steps, such as if you're cutting your bangs, never cut above the finger. If you have cowlicks and stuff, take that into consideration that the hair is going to jump up or to separate. So don't put that much tension onto the hair when you're trying to cut it.
And when you say don't put too much tension on it, you mean, say, for example, I'm cutting my own bangs and I pull my bangs down. So I wouldn't want to pull them real tight down.
Have them loose enough that they're still going to have a buckle or a bend to them with your fingers.
If I'm cutting my bangs, should I start maybe like, you know, cutting really long and then going shorter?
Absolutely. You can always take more off, but you can never add it back on.
Oh, that's so true. I've seen some photos of men trying or young men trying to cut their own hair, give themselves fades. If a man wanted to cut his own hair, you know, take off some of it, the fade has been growing out. Do you have any advice on using clippers during this time?
Yes. Number one, a fade, a high and tight, flat top, any of those clipper cut haircuts are a designed haircut and they're not an easy haircut. But I would suggest maybe trying to take the clippers and trim around your ears, fold the ear down and enough just to trim around it, just to give it more of a clean, tidier look. But if you are going to try to do a clipper cut, you have to have a mirror behind you and a mirror in front of you, but you also got to realize a mirrored image is always a reverse image. So it's a lot harder to cut than what you think it is, but you also have to use your hand to feel the bone structure and know where to stop as well as where to blend in.
If people are at home and they shouldn't be going anywhere, they shouldn't really be worrying about their hair.
Right. And a lot of guys have had short hair for many years, which is fine. But this is also a way to try new styles, you know, add a little bit more gel to it, to slick it down, to smooth it back, or to even, you know, allow some hair growth to change your style into a new you, new look.
What about box color? Say, for example, I've been going to a stylist to get my hair colored for years, but then I've got some gray growth coming in. What are some of the risks that I would take by using box color, you know, for a few months during the stay-at-home order? And then when I go back to my stylist, what are some problems she's going to have when she tries to recolor my hair like it was before?
A lot of box colors are, number one, they have metallic dyes in them, so it makes it harder on us to go back against that because it can damage your hair, but not knowing the color wheel and knowing what shades to use and not knowing how to apply the hair color properly can be very damaging to your hair. I would suggest that, number one, not to use home color or box color because there's no guarantee. And then also, if you are a brunette and you want to be blonde, you have to go through so many stages to get to that blonde stage and the proper stage of blonde that you're not going to get in one application from a box. There is a science behind that that's going to achieve the color that you want, but a box color is not going to give you that in one application.
So basically, we just need to wait till our stylists open back up again and we go back and see them.
Yes, and then too, for ladies who have grays, or guys for that matter, you can always use eyeshadow and shadow it in and then just put some hairspray on it to help set it. It's not going to color the hair. It's going to help camouflage the hair and help you get through this time. But if you are a brunette and coloring your hair blonde, you can always use baby powder or, you know, a lighter eyeshadow to shadow it to the point of softening the brown to blend in with the blonde. But once again, it's not going to completely cover the hair. It's just going to help camouflage it and help you not be so worried about gray hair or the dark roots of the hair color.
And that would be a good idea for people who are working remotely from home on Zoom meetings or, you know, face-to-face phone call meetings, that they could kind of camouflage for now the color change that's coming through, the new color growth that's coming in. What are some of the things people could do to kind of camouflage their grown out hair, their long shaggy haircuts? Maybe they're even starting to grow into mullets.
Sadly, mullets are making their way back. It's not my favorite, but hey, if it's in for the trend, then let it be. But also for ladies, you can always do more volumizer to help lift from the roots. That way it's not so flat and obvious to the gray. Tease a little bit, you know, just to give it a little bit more fluff. That way it's not going to be so harsh. But for the most part, it's one of those things that a color is a color, and it is going to be, you know, hard to blend that. But you can go in there and, like I said, do different styles with your hair. That way it's going to give you a little bit more of an illusion and not so obvious. But even with guys and stuff that color their hair, it's going to be one of those things that I would suggest just basically weather the storm.
Earl Burns, master stylist in Richmond, Kentucky, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Almost cut my hair. It happened just the other day. It's getting kind of long. I could have said it was in my way, but I didn't.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.